Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 10th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a graveyard scene. There are three gentlemen all dressed in tuxedos. There are Texas Governor Greg Abbott, Senator Mitch McConnell, and I believe the third is Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA. They're all holding shovels. LaPierre is also holding an assault rifle. There are two newly dug graves. The headstones say Uvalde 2022, Buffalo 2022. But there are tombstones going on and on in the background. The ones we see say Newton 2012, Las Vegas 2017, Sutherland Springs 2017, Atlanta 2021, El Paso 2019. Thousand Oaks 2018, Virginia Beach 2019, Parkland 2018, and there are many more in the background. The headline is A Policy Choice: The GOP's and NRA's Refusal to Change Gun Laws in Response to Massacres. That is our first main story, and we will start there. A new push for gun laws as Uvalde mourns what happened. As grieving parents in Uvalde, Texas, began burying the 19 children and two teachers gunned down at Robb Elementary School this week, a bipartisan group of senators began exploring whether there's a path forward for even modest gun control measures. We're at a point in this debate and in the trajectory of gun violence where we need something, said Senator Chris Murphy, the Democrat from Connecticut, who is leading talks with Republican senators, including Patrick Toomey, Republican, Pennsylvania, and John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas. Democrats want to pass an assault weapons ban and universal background checks, but Murphy said Republicans had ruled those out. He held out guarded hope for expanding background checks and creating incentives for states to pass red flag laws that make it easier to take guns from or block gun sales to troubled people deemed dangerous. After the deadliest school shooting in a decade, Murphy said, there are many more Republicans willing to talk right now. Still, most Republicans insisted that gun safety laws would not stop mass shootings, leaving in doubt whether any proposals might get the 10 Republican votes needed to overcome a filibuster. President Biden met with the families of the victims in Uvalde and vowed to meet with lawmakers to discuss gun legislation. He said he saw a chance to work with rational Republicans, but Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has blocked all gun control efforts for decades, said the problems that need targeting are mental illness and school safety. In Uvalde, weeping parents, students, and community members attended the first funerals and burials for the 19 students and two teachers. A coffin maker donated small caskets for the dead children, decorated with motifs including a cartoon dinosaur, butterflies, and a Superman logo. At a rosary service for 10-year-old Maddie Rodriguez, relatives remembered a charismatic girl who loved animals and wanted to be a marine biologist. She was determined, said her cousin Destiny Escobar. She was going to be someone. What the editorial said. The usual calls for restricting Americans' gun rights have arrived on cue, said the Wall Street Journal. But the mass shootings in Uvalde, Buffalo, and elsewhere point to a deeper malady that gun laws can fix. Background checks won't stop youthful shooters who rarely have criminal records. And with 400 million guns already in circulation, an age barrier or a waiting period won't stop anyone determined to kill. To pretend such laws will solve mass shootings is to ignore the much larger problem of mental illness, profound social alienation, and the collapse of cultural guardrails. Let's stop pretending there's nothing we can do, said the Miami Herald, as we reel from the obscenity of another young male mowing down innocents with military-grade weapons. We must ban the assault weapons that no individual should own. And we can pass a bill expanding background checks on gun buyers that the House has already approved. A new Morning Consult poll found that 67% of Americans support banning assault weapons and 88% back universal background checks. Perversely, Republicans prefer to do nothing even as we continue counting up the bodies of dead kids. What the columnist said. We need to pass and enforce red flag laws, said David French in the Dispatch. They would allow a family member, school official, or police officer to obtain a court order for seizing the weapons of someone who's a demonstrable threat and prevent them from buying new ones. While we're at it, let's stop selling all firearms to children and raise the required age to 21, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. An 18-year-old is still developing neurologically and is more susceptible to acting on anger and aggression. What rational society would sell a teenager a semi-automatic gun that can slaughter dozens of people in minutes? Imposing new restrictions on legal firearms purchases would do little to reduce gun crime, said Kevin Williamson in National Review. Only 2% of criminals in federal prisons bought weapons from licensed dealers, according to a 2019 Justice Department study. But Democrats aren't trying to save lives. They're waging a culture war. They want to make hayseeds and would-be militiamen the face of America's violent crime problem, when in truth such crime is concentrated in big Democratic cities and disproportionately committed by low-income African Americans. New gun safety laws may draw remarkably broad support from the public, but that doesn't change the calculus for Republican lawmakers, said Carl Hulse in the New York Times. Most are from deeply conservative districts or states where gun rights are considered sacred, no matter how much blood is spilled. Republicans who support any significant gun restrictions know they are likely to face primaries and lose their jobs. Face it. Our democratic system is broken, said Charles Sykes in the Bulwark. Faced with endless mass shootings and daily gun carnage, a nation that once put men on the moon is mired in paralysis and hopelessness. An America that won't act to stop the periodic slaughter of schoolchildren is in crisis, perhaps in terminal decline. And we'll read the second main story today. Russia recovers momentum in the Donbas. What happened? Ukraine's grip on its eastern Donbas region slipped further this week as Russian troops took much of Severodonetsk, one of the last Ukrainian strongholds in the area. Most of the city's 100,000 people have either fled or been killed, leaving just 12,000. Ukrainian officials say the Russians control 70% of the municipality, although most of its homes and virtually all of its infrastructure have been destroyed. The Russian attack has been indiscriminate. A Russian airstrike pierced a nitric acid tank at a chemical plant, spewing a toxic cloud that forced Severodonetsk remaining inhabitants to hide in their homes. Russia has also reportedly used thermite, a banned incendiary compound that can burn through metal. Further south, the Ukrainian army struck back with a counteroffensive on the Russian-controlled city Kherson, but with limited success. President Biden announced the U.S. would send Ukraine advanced rocket systems with a range of 50 miles, but not the 200-mile range rockets capable of firing into Russia that Kyiv requested. Officials said such offensive weapons could escalate a conflict that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has already called a total war of the West against Russia. Meanwhile, Western support for Kyiv showed signs of cracking. Germany slowed its military aid, while French and Italian leaders called for a ceasefire that would require Ukrainian territorial concessions. At the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, last week, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger urged immediate ceasefire negotiations and a return to the pre-invasion status quo, which included Russian control of Crimea and part of the Donbas. An incensed President Volodymyr Zelensky compared Kissinger's suggestion to the appeasement of Nazi Germany in 1938, but added that he would still consider that outcome a victory. What the editorial said. This is no way to win a war, said the Wall Street Journal. Russia's firepower advantage will inflict horrible losses, and long-range rockets could remedy the imbalance. But our president seems bent on reassuring Vladimir Putin about what the U.S. won't do, and he has failed to rally a coalition to break Russia's blockade of Ukrainian wheat exports, dooming poor nations to hunger. Most Americans support Ukraine, said the Minneapolis Star Tribune, but rising prices are weakening their resolve. In a March poll, 55% prioritized strong sanctions against Russia over limiting damage to the U.S. economy. By May, only 41% did. And though Republicans are mostly stalwart in their support of Ukraine, 11 GOP senators and 57 House representatives opposed the $40 billion aid package approved last week. That faction could grow and nix further aid if Republicans retake Congress in the fall. What the columnist said. The tide is turning toward Russia, said David French in the Dispatch. Its military has historically made a habit of failing early before roaring back, and it could soon choke off Ukraine's industrial and agricultural heartland. Some Ukrainian troops are already refusing to go to what one called certain death. Yet the U.S. continues to funnel weapons into Ukraine while trying to maintain the fiction that Washington is not involved, said Christopher Caldwell in the New York Times. We are giving the conflict a momentum that may be impossible to stop, even as the Biden administration keeps closing off avenues of negotiation. It makes no sense to negotiate and offer Russia an off-ramp, said Timothy Snyder in his Substack newsletter. If Putin wins, he'll take chunks of Ukraine regardless. But if he feels cornered, he doesn't have to escalate. He can simply change the fairy tale he tells Russians and declare victory. Ukrainians understand that, just as they know that regions ceded to Russia would become hellholes of torture, rape, and execution. Ukraine's allies in the U.S. and Europe must embrace the simple necessity of Russian defeat. The conflict has bogged down into a World War I-style war of attrition, said Andreas Kluth in Bloomberg. Zelensky says up to 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying each day, while the Pentagon estimates that Russia has depleted 20% of its forces. Russia retains too much conventional military might for Ukraine to push it out altogether. Eventually, sheer exhaustion will prod both sides to negotiate. The result could be a Korea-like frozen truce. That may seem intolerable to Ukraine, but the devastating reality is that this war can lead only to outcomes that are messy and tragic. Controversy of the week is January 6th. Here come the televised hearings. The GOP's January 6th cover-up is still happening, even now, said Amanda Carpenter in the Bulwark. Last week, Kevin McCarthy, the top Republican in the House, indicated he would not cooperate with the Select Committee's investigation into the deadly attack on the Capitol. joining Representatives Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, Scott Perry, Republican Pennsylvania, and at least two other subpoenaed Republican House members in choosing to stonewall the critical inquiry into the organized violent attempt to overturn a presidential election. McCarthy and Jordan were in direct contact with Trump that fateful day, with McCarthy pleading in vain with then-president to publicly call off the mob assaulting the Capitol. The next day, a clearly disgusted McCarthy said that Trump bears responsibility for the riot. Yet now McCarthy insists the investigation serves no legitimate legislative purpose. Nonsense. He could testify about Trump's state of mind as his supporters tried to force Congress to halt its electoral vote counting. He could also reveal whether Trump later threatened McCarthy if he told the truth about their January 6 call, or offered him inducements to lie or remain silent. How could any official sit on this information, let alone a man who could very soon be Speaker of the House? I'm all for a tough, comprehensive investigation into the January 6 insurrection, said Nicholas Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. But this committee has squandered its credibility. The panel was born in original sin the moment House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made the decision to blackball two of the committee members proposed by the GOP leadership, choosing instead to install two anti-Trump Republican rebels, Liz Cheney, Republican Wyoming, and Adam Kinzinger, Republican Illinois. In polls, about 8 in 10 Republicans view this supposedly bipartisan committee as nothing more than a kangaroo court. If Democrats had let McCarthy install Trump-supporting House members on the committee, they could have ranted and raved, but at least Republicans wouldn't now be able to say they'd been silenced. That's pure nonsense, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Republicans have been trying to sabotage this committee from the outset, and one of the members they wanted to put on the panel was Jordan, whose complicity in the insurrection is under active investigation. The American public deserves to have a full, honest accounting of who participated in the plot to subvert our constitutional and political order. After interviewing more than 1,000 witnesses, the committee has already dug up some astonishing allegations. They include testimony that Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff, told others that Trump said while watching the riot that perhaps the mob was right. Vice President Mike Pence should be hung. Witnesses also have testified that a frantic Meadows burned documents in his White House office fireplace. Who knows what else the committee's televised hearings, starting June 9th, will reveal. Those primetime hearings may prove to be the most fascinating since Watergate, said Dean Obadala in CNN.com. The committee promises tens of thousands of pieces of evidence and testimony from dozens of witnesses, including tape testimony from Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. Will there be surprise cameos from Pence or other key players? Will the hearings lead to a criminal referral of the former president to the Justice Department? Get ready for the biggest blockbuster of the summer. It was a good week for Shanghai, where residents were finally allowed to leave their homes after 2 months of a rigorously enforced COVID lockdown. Authorities banned the phrase lockdown, insisting on the term static management. It was a good week for coffee drinkers, who were up to 21% less likely to die than those who didn't drink coffee during a 7-year study of about 120,000 British people. Coffee drinkers who added a teaspoon of sugar were up to 31% less likely to die. It was a good week for picking up takeout orders yourself. After a survey of 500 delivery drivers found that 4 in 5 admitted to sometimes eating part of the customer's order. But it was a bad week for Nancy Crampton Brophy, an Oregon-based romance novelist and author of the 2011 essay, How to Murder Your Husband, who was found guilty of murdering her husband. Jurors were not told about the essay, but did learn Brophy owned a gun exactly like the one used to kill her husband before she collected his life insurance. It was a bad week for cooling off, with news of a national lifeguard shortage that could prevent the opening of about 100,000 public swimming pools this year. The shortage was largely caused by pandemic interruptions to training programs and work visas for foreign teens. Finally, it was a bad week for the Mona Lisa, which was pelted with cake in the Louvre Museum by a man disguised as an old woman in a wheelchair. The cake thrower, whose attack was stopped by a glass case, shouted that he was protesting people who are destroying the planet. The briefing this week is titled Afghanistan's Misery. Under Taliban rule, Afghans are suffering from widespread hunger, desperate poverty, and brutal oppression. How has life changed? Afghanistan has deteriorated dramatically since President Biden ordered the U.S. military to complete its withdrawal in August. When the Taliban returned to power, women's rights advocates took to the streets, demanding to keep advances made during the U.S. occupation, such as education for girls. Many of those protesters were beaten and detained, while activists fled or went into hiding. In March, the Taliban announced that girls could only attend school up to the sixth grade. Last month, the hardline government announced that Muslim women must be covered from head to toe while in public, with only their eyes exposed, and ordered women TV broadcasters to cover their faces. Now women have started vanishing from the workforce. "What I am worried about," said Katira Ahmadi, a news presenter at Tolo News, "is that next they will ban us from coming to work completely." How is Afghanistan's economy doing? It has virtually collapsed. Afghanistan's economy was heavily dependent on foreign aid, which made up nearly 80% of the government's budget before the Taliban took over. Foreign aid has been reduced to a trickle as countries reduce or even suspend assistance to the Taliban-led government because of its human rights abuses. The United States plans to use $3.5 billion of frozen Afghanistan central bank assets to pay judgment debts to the families of 9/11 victims, money the Afghan people say belongs to them and is sorely needed. Nearly 1 million Afghans have lost their jobs since the Taliban takeover. Restrictions on women's employment have led to up to $1 billion of economic loss, or about 5% of Afghanistan's GDP, said UN Women Executive Director Seema Bahaus. "There is almost universal poverty in the country," she said. "In extreme situations, people desperate for money are selling their daughters into marriage or selling their own organs, which is illegal yet commonplace." Gul Muhammad, a laborer in Herat, received $4,500 for his 15-year-old son's kidney to pay off his debts. Unable to find a job, he's recently started borrowing money again. What's causing the food crisis? Many Afghans have little or no income to buy food for their families. Meanwhile, prices keep rising due to inflation, supply chain woes, and higher customs fees. Afghanistan has also experienced extreme drought conditions for several years, and the damaged crops are producing low yields. The Russian war in Ukraine has raised fuel prices and caused global wheat shortages, putting Afghanistan on the brink of famine. The United Nations estimates that 95% of Afghans do not have enough food, and half the population of 39 million is suffering from acute hunger. The UN has asked for $4.4 billion in aid to prevent a food and water crisis that could kill more Afghans than 20 years of war. Farmers have told me that through decades of war, they have never had to stand in line for humanitarian assistance until now, said Mary Ellen McGroarty, the World Food Program's country director for Afghanistan. It's all just imploded for them. What's the security situation? After being quiet for months, Afghanistan's Islamic State affiliate, known as Islamic State Khorasan, or ISIS-K, has carried out a string of deadly attacks targeting minorities. Formed in 2015 by disillusioned Pakistani Taliban fighters, ISIS-K seeks to purify the country through destabilizing mass casualty attacks. ISIS-K wants to show its breadth and reach beyond Afghanistan, said Afsandar Mir, a senior expert at the United States Institute of Peace. In April, a spate of attacks throughout the country killed at least 77 people. At least four of them were carried out by ISIS-K. The attacks included a blast at a Kabul public high school targeting the minority Shiite Hazara community, and an explosion at a Sufi mosque in northern Kunduz province that killed more than 30 worshippers. How is the world responding? The U.S. and other Western countries have sought to provide humanitarian aid while not letting money flow to the Taliban, but that's easier said than done. The World Food Program has set up food distribution centers, and China and India have also sent food aid. Along with the money set aside for 9/11 families, the U.S. has also frozen an additional $3.5 billion in Afghanistan's central bank assets, which it intends to move to a trust fund benefiting the Afghan people. But legal red tape could tie up that money for years. Meanwhile, a group of Democratic senators has noted the Biden administration is on pace to resettle just 10% of the 125,000 Afghan refugees Biden promised to welcome. There's a clear difference in treatment between Afghan and Ukrainian refugees, whom the U.S. has embraced, said Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. My question is why this approach is reserved for a select few, he said, when refugees from Afghanistan and around the world facing persecution, instability, and violence face barriers to entry that Ukrainians get to bypass. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Durham's laughable investigation. Special Counsel John Durham tried to prove that the FBI investigation of Russian election interference was a criminal plot, said Jonathan Chait. 3 years later, Durham's theory has been debunked. Durham was appointed in 2019 by former Attorney General Bill Barr to prove that the FBI never had grounds to investigate Donald Trump for his role in Russia's 2016 attack on U.S. elections. This week, a jury humiliated Durham when it took only 6 hours to acquit Hillary Clinton lawyer Michael Sussman of perjury. The prosecutor alleged that Sussman concealed that he had worked for Clinton when he tipped the FBI about unusual activity on a Kremlin-connected Alpha Bank server in Trump Tower. The entire case was weak tea, since the FBI clearly knew Sussman had Democratic ties. More importantly, the FBI was already investigating the Trump-Russia connection. Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was giving polling data to a Russian agent. Russia hacked Democratic emails, and Trump cited them 160 times. His campaign lied about more than 100 contacts with Russians. The FBI thought Trump posed a security threat to the U.S. because he did. This is from the U.K. China could be spying on the British. What if our streets were plastered with Russian-made CCTV cameras equipped with facial recognition software and microphones? Thankfully, Russia doesn't possess such a fleet of potential spying machines, said Ross Clark. But China does. Two Chinese firms, Hikvision and Dahua, have become big players in our CCTV market. Of 1,300 public bodies in the United Kingdom that responded to Freedom of Information requests, 800, including nearly 75% of legal counsels and nearly a third of police forces, confirmed that they had cameras made by those firms on their premises. Many government ministries have them. In fact, it was a Hikvision camera that captured married former Health Secretary Matt Hancock breaching COVID restrictions by fondling an aide. The security risks this network of cameras presents should be glaringly obvious. Using Chinese technology to monitor our streets gives China's government a valuable asset in war. And by luring Hikvision products, by buying Hikvision products, we support a company whose cameras monitor Uyghur Muslims locked in dystopian internment camps. U.S. authorities have already banned Hikvision and Dahua from selling surveillance equipment in the States. The U.K. should do the same. This column comes from India. That macho symbol on an upper lip. The lush Indian mustache is more than just a fashion statement, said Rahul Bedi. It's a symbol of respect, privilege, honor, and above all, machismo. Many Indians consider cutting off a mustache to be an unpardonable insult that can lead to clan feuds. Men in Punjab and Rajasthan states in particular live by the saying, "He who has no mustache has no standing." To the Sikhs, a mustache should be thick and stiff enough to balance a lemon on its upturned ends. Among police, the mustachioed occupy an unstated, albeit higher, status. Indeed, in some states, policemen have even been paid stipends to grow mustaches, because police chiefs believe that whiskered lawmen generate a positive and masterful aura. But the reverence inspired by the mustache can also make it a locus of casteism or of rebellion. In 2018, for example, hundreds of Dalits from the lowest caste, once known as Untouchables, launched a social media campaign after a Dalit was assaulted by members of upper caste for daring to sport a fine mustache. Since then, upturned whiskers have become a symbol of Dalit defiance. In some countries, men going through a midlife crisis end up buying a Harley. In India, though, we grow mustaches to get over it. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. Titled this week, Why More is Never Enough. Evolution has ensured that humans will invariably be dissatisfied with what we have, said Arthur Brooks in The Atlantic. That's why the key to happiness is learning to want less. I glanced into my teenage daughter's bedroom one spring afternoon last year, expecting to find her staring absent-mindedly at the Zoom screen that passed for high school during the pandemic. Instead, she was laughing uproariously at a video she had found. I asked her what she was looking at. "It's an old man dancing like a chicken and singing," she told me. I came over to her laptop, not being above watching someone making an idiot of himself for 15 seconds of social media fame. What I found instead was the septuagenarian rock star Mick Jagger in a fairly recent concert croaking out the Rolling Stones mega hit, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," a song that debuted on the charts when I was a year old, for probably the millionth time. An audience of tens of thousands of what looked to be mostly baby boomers and Gen Xers sang along rapturously. "Is this serious?" she asked. "Do people your age actually like this?" I took umbrage, but had to admit that it was a legitimate question. "Kind of," I answered. "It wasn't just the music or even the performance," I assured her. To my mind, the longevity of that particular song, number 2 on the Rolling Stone magazine's original list of the 500 greatest songs of all time, has a lot to do with a deep truth it speaks. As we wind our way through life, I explain, satisfaction, the joy from fulfillment of our wishes or expectations, is evanescent. No matter what we achieve, see, acquire, or do, it seems to slip from our grasp. I was now on a roll. "Satisfaction," I told my daughter, "is the greatest paradox of human life. We crave it. We believe we can get it. We glimpse it and maybe even experience it for a brief moment. And then it vanishes. But we never give up on our quest to get and hold on to it. I try and I try and I try and I try," Jagger sings. "How? Through sex and consumerism," according to the song, "by building a life that is ever more baroque, expensive, and laden with crap." "You'll see," I told her. Mick Jagger's satisfaction dilemma, and ours, starts with a rudimentary formula. Satisfaction equals getting what you want. It's so simple, and yet its power is deeply encoded within us. Give a 3-year-old the French fry she is reaching for and see her satisfied expression. But then, after a couple of seconds, watch the wanting return. And that's the actual problem, isn't it? The Stone song should really have been titled, "I Can't Keep No Satisfaction." It's almost as if our brains are programmed to prevent us from enjoying anything for very long. In fact, they are. The term homeostasis was introduced in 1926 by a physiologist named Walter B. Cannon, who showed in his book, The Wisdom of the Body, that we have built-in mechanisms to regulate our temperature, as well as our levels of oxygen, water, salt, sugar, protein, fat, and calcium. But the concept applies much more broadly than that. To survive, all living systems tend to maintain stable conditions as best they can. When you get an emotional shock, good or bad, your brain wants to re-equilibrate, making it hard to stay on the high or low for very long. It's why when you achieve conventional acquisitive success, you can never get enough. If you base your sense of self-worth on success, money, power, prestige, you will run from victory to victory, initially to keep feeling good, and then to avoid feeling awful. The unending race against the headwinds of homeostasis has a name: the hedonic treadmill. No matter how fast we run, we never arrive. At home, I dream that at Naples, at Rome, I can be intoxicated with beauty and lose my sadness, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in his 1841 essay, Self-Reliance. I pack my trunk, embrace my friends, embark on the sea, and at last wake up in Naples. And there beside me is the stern fact, the sad self, unrelenting, identical, that I fled from. Scholars argue over whether our happiness has an immutable set point, or if it might be moved around a little over the course of our life due to general circumstances. But no one has ever found that immediate bliss from a major victory or achievement will endure. The nature of adaptation condemns men to live on a hedonic treadmill. The psychologist Philip Brickman and Donald T. Campbell wrote in 1971, "To seek new levels of stimulation merely to maintain old levels of subjective pleasure, to never achieve any kind of permanent happiness or satisfaction." Yet even if you recognize all this, getting off the treadmill is hard. It feels dangerous. Our urge for more is quite powerful, but stronger still is our resistance to less. So you find yourself running simply to avoid being thrown off the back of the treadmill. According to evolutionary psychology, our tendency to strive for more is perfectly understandable. Throughout most of human history, starvation loomed closer than it does, for the most part, today. A rich caveman had a few extra animal skins and arrowheads, and maybe a few piles of seeds and dried fish to spare. With this plenty, he might survive a bad winter. Our troglodyte ancestors didn't just want to make it through the winter, though. They had bigger ambitions. They wanted to find allies and mates, too, with the goal, whether conscious or not, of passing on their genes. And what would make that possible? Among other things, the accumulation of animal skins, demonstrating greater competence, prowess, and attractiveness than the hominid in the next cave over. Surprisingly little has changed since then. Scholars have shown that our acquisitive tendencies persist amid plenty and regularly exceed our needs. Competing with rivals for mates helps explain our weird fixation on social comparison. When we think about satisfaction from success, or possessions, or fitness, or good looks, there's another element to consider. Success is relative. Satisfaction requires not just that you continuously run in place on your own hedonic treadmill, but that you run slightly faster than other people are running on theirs. We live in a time when we are regularly counseled to get back to nature, to our long-ago past, in our diets, our sense of communal obligation, and more. But if our goal is happiness that endures, following our natural urges does not help us in the main. That is Mother Nature's cruel hoax. Happiness doesn't help propagate the species, so nature doesn't select for it. If you conflate intergenerational survival with happiness, that's your problem, not nature's. In fact, our natural state is dissatisfaction, punctuated by brief moments of satisfaction. You might not like the hedonic treadmill, but Mother Nature thinks it's pretty great. She likes watching you strive to achieve an elusive goal because strivers get the goods, even if they don't enjoy them for long. The urge to have more than others, to be more than others, tugs at us relentlessly. The insatiable goals to acquire more, succeed conspicuously, and be as attractive as possible lead us to objectify one another, and even ourselves. When people see themselves as little more than their attractive bodies, jobs, or bank accounts, it brings great suffering. Studies show that self-objectification is associated with a sense of invisibility and lack of autonomy, and physical self-objectification has a direct relationship with eating disorders and depression in women. Professional self-objectification is a tyranny every bit as nasty. You become a heartless taskmaster to yourself, seeing yourself as nothing more than homo economicus. Love and fun are sacrificed for another day of work in search of a positive internal answer to the question, "Am I successful yet?" We become cardboard cutouts of real people. For the faithful, satisfaction has another name, heaven. Many religions promise heaven to believers. We rarely think carefully about what that entails, harps and clouds, but the Roman Catholic Church is helpfully specific about it. Heaven grants us the beatific vision, God showing himself to us face to face, making us know his true nature, and thereby granting us the fulfillment of the deepest human longings, the state of supreme, definitive happiness. Or as the English mystic Juliana of Norwich wrote of heaven, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. In other words, heaven is pure satisfaction that lasts. Why can't we seem to be so well on earth? The 13th century Catholic priest Thomas Aquinas answers this in his Magisterial Summa Theologia. Even if you are not a religious believer, Thomas' list of the goals that beguile but never satisfy rings true. They include money, power, pleasure, and honor. As Thomas puts it in the case of money, in the desire for wealth and for whatsoever temporal goods, when we already possess them, we despise them and seek others. The reason of this is that we realize more their insufficiency when we possess them, and this very fact shows that they are imperfect, and the sovereign good does not consist therein. The satisfaction problem is our natural attachment to those inadequate things. If this sounds a bit Buddhist to you, it should. It is very similar to the Buddha's first noble truth, that life is suffering, dukkha in Sanskrit, also translated as dissatisfaction, and that the cause of this suffering is craving, desire, and attachment to worldly things. Thomas Aquinas and the Buddha, and Jagger for that matter, were saying the same thing. Note that neither Thomas nor the Buddha argued that worldly rewards are inherently evil. In fact, they can be used for great good. Money is crucial for a functioning society and supporting your family. Power can be wielded to lift others up. Pleasure leavens life. And honor can attract attention to the sources of moral elevation. But as attachments, as ends instead of means, the problem is simple. They cannot satisfy. In truth, our formula, satisfaction equals getting what you want, leaves out one key component. To be more accurate, it should be satisfaction equals what you have divided by what you want. All of our evolutionary and biological imperatives focus on increasing the numerator, our haves. But the more significant action is in the denominator, our wants. The modern world is made up of clever ways to make our wants explode without us realizing it. Even the Dalai Lama, arguably the world's most enlightened man, admits to it. Sometimes I visit supermarkets, he says in The Art of Happiness. I really love to see supermarkets because I can see so many beautiful things. So when I look at all these different articles, I develop a feeling of desire, and my initial impulse might be, oh, I want this, I want that. The secret to satisfaction is not to increase our haves. That will never work, or at least it will never last. That is the treadmill formula, not the satisfaction formula. The secret is to manage our wants. By managing what we want instead of what we have, we give ourselves a chance to lead more satisfied lives. My daughter went off to college a few months after our talk about the science of satisfaction. After the isolation and lockdowns of COVID and the sad joke that was her senior year of high school, she made a run for the border, enrolling at a university in Spain. I am bereft. We do send each other several messages every day, though. They are almost never about work or school. Instead, we share small moments, a photo of a rainy street, a silly joke, the number of push-ups she just did. I don't know whether this is giving her a head start on freeing herself from the paradox of dissatisfaction, but it is like medicine for me. Each message is like the evening of the flower, a brief glimpse of the beatific vision of heaven, perhaps bringing quiet satisfaction. Each of us can ride the waves of attachments and urges, hoping futilely that someday, somehow, we will get and keep that satisfaction we crave. Or we can take a shot at free will and self-mastery. It's a lifelong battle against our inner caveman. Often he wins. But with determination and practice, we can find respite from that chronic dissatisfaction and experience the joy that is true human freedom. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in The Atlantic. Here's an obituary for you. The Goodfellas star who radiated danger, Ray Liotta, 1954 to 2022. Nobody conveyed simmering menace like Ray Liotta. The actor took on many roles during a four-decade career, but he made his name playing criminals and other shady characters who combined roguish charisma with a volatility that lurked just below the surface. The first of these was Melanie Griffith's psychopathic ex-husband Ray in Jonathan Demme's 1986 road movie Something Wild. But by far his most famous role was mobster Henry Hill in Martin Scorsese's wise guy epic Goodfellas from 1990. Liotta commands the screen for much of the movie's 2.5 hours, playing the real-life mafioso from his youthful mob apprenticeship to his exit into the witness protection program. Liotta was also lauded for his portrayal of Shoeless Joe Jackson in 1989's baseball drama Field of Dreams. Even at rest, Ray seems like he has boiling cauldron inside, said fellow actor Alessandro Nivola. You never know when it might erupt. Liotta grew up in Union, New Jersey, where he was adopted from an orphanage at 6 months, said the Washington Post. His father owned a chain of auto parts stores, while his mother was a clerk for the township. A standout athlete in high school, he showed no interest in acting until he was recruited for a play his senior year. He subsequently majored in drama at the University of Miami. Moving to New York, he did commercials and landed a recurring role on Another World. He scored his breakout role in Something Wild through Griffith, whose former boyfriend was a college friend. But Liotta had to lobby for his iconic role in Goodfellas, said the Associated Press. First, he sold himself to Scorsese. Then the pair embarked on multiple auditions and pleas to the studio to cast the still relative unknown. After Goodfellas, Liotta was never short of work, said the Telegraph, but big-ticket parts eluded him. And despite his efforts to resist typecasting, he was increasingly cast in roles that showed his talent for criminals, misfits, and outsiders. Still, Liotta never stopped trying to branch out, playing Frank Sinatra in the 1998 HBO movie The Rat Pack, and performing in a pair of Muppets movies. You want to do as many different genres as you can, he said in 2018. That's what a career should be. And we've just enough time for some of the shorter pieces. Here's some notes on the Talking Points page. Since the Columbine High Massacre in 1999, more than 311,000 children at 331 schools have been exposed to gun violence within their schools. Guns surpassed motor vehicles accidents as the leading cause of death for kids for the first time in 2020. The most recent year for which CDC data is available. That year, 4,368 Americans, 19 and under, were killed by guns, two-thirds of them homicide victims. About 30% were suicides. Republican candidates have this year produced more than 100 TV ads that feature candidates shooting, brandishing, or lauding guns. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey pulled a little Smith & Wesson from her purse and aimed it. Jake Beckett, an Arkansas U.S. Senate candidate, said he believes in babies, borders, bullets. An Ohio House candidate, J. Arm Majewski, displayed a rifle, said, "I'm willing to do whatever it takes to return this country back to its former glory," and pulled the trigger. American drivers drove 753 billion miles in the first 3 months of 2022, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. That's the highest first quarter figure since record keeping began in 1970, and it helped fuel a 4% increase in U.S. carbon dioxide emissions. And we will finish the show today with a quote from Mahatma Gandhi, quoted in The Atlantic. He says, "There is no path to peace. Peace is the path." Nice thought to end on. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.